one thing I would say, and it's very strong ground in the climate science community now, is that we can say with high confidence that the increase in the mean global temperature over the past 100 to 150 years is a result of anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions. And this, you know, often gets debated outside, I think, climate science as to which, you know, political standpoint you're aligned to, but it's really a resolved question, I'd say, within this climate science community.
Hello, we're back, and we're here with another episode of the How to Be Good podcast. And once again, we have a fantastic guest for you. So, who is it? Tell us more, Anka.
Yes, he's a risk scientist. He specializes in coastal flood risk areas. He actually lives in the affected areas on the eastern coast. And he's going to tell us all about the risk assessments that governments, larger companies are going through at the moment.
Yeah, he's been super busy in the last couple of weeks because of the floods and everything. We even had to cancel one of our previous bookings so that he could speak to the news and everything else like that and talk to everyone about the huge floods that have been going on over in the eastern states in Australia.
Indeed, yes. I think it has been a busy couple of weeks for him, and he has all the information to share with us during this podcast.
Excellent. Well, let's get to it. And as usual, follow us, share, send us a review, log into your friends' phones and make them share as well. And we'll get straight into it and listen to the show. Hello and welcome to the How to Be Good podcast. Today we are joined by Thomas Mortlock, a risk scientist. How are you doing?
Oh yeah, I'm good, thanks Gareth.
Good, good. So before anything else, could you tell us what a risk scientist does and a little bit of background on risk frontiers, please?
Yeah, sure. So a risk scientist is very much a broad term. I guess you can work in risk in many different aspects, but specifically, the risk area that I work in is looking at the risk of natural hazard events, and even more specifically, the risk of weather and climate events on government operations, on private sector organisations, and indeed also on emergency management as well. And in terms of Risk Frontiers, the company that I work for, we are in fact the longest running natural hazards research centre in Australia, founded inside Macquarie University in Sydney in 1994. At that time, actually sponsored by the reinsurance organisations, the reinsurance industry in Australia, because there was a realisation at that point that there wasn't all that much understanding about how natural hazard events impact financials of organisations. And so we were set up with that remit, stayed inside the university till 2017 and have since spun out, now an independent employee-owned organisation based in Sydney. And really, I think what we aim to do at least is provide objective, high-quality information on climate research and modelling, with particular regard to how climate change and how extreme weather and climate risk impacts the financials, the bottom line of private sector organisations.
Fantastic. So how did you end up becoming a risk scientist? I mean, it's one of those subjects that seems a little a little vague in terms of its point. You know, somebody goes to university, I'm going to be a doctor or I'm going to be an architect. And a risk scientist is not one I hear too often. But so how did you end up there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I hadn't heard of risk scientists, I have to say, till about 5 years ago. And as I said, you know, it's a very broad term. You could be a risk scientist in many different disciplines. My background, my undergrad was in oceanography. I then did a master's in coastal engineering, and I worked as a coastal engineer in the UK for 4 years before doing my PhD over here in Australia. And I came over to Australia in 2012 in environmental sciences. And really, up until that point, especially through the PhD, it was very much academically focused. You know, very much into research around coastal climate risk. Until I heard of Risk Frontiers, and Risk Frontiers heard of me, and it really opened up a world for me that I didn't know existed, where industry was very had a large interest in the research, in natural hazard research that people were doing with inside the universities. And really the reason for that is, if people haven't heard of reinsurance before, is that they're probably the largest companies in the world that you never heard of. So big organizations that insure insurance companies, because insurance companies can often cover themselves against the risk of a theft of a car, let's say. But for natural hazard risk, everyone claims at once. And often these insurance companies are not big enough to cover themselves against Nat Cat or natural catastrophe risk and loss. So these larger reinsurance companies buy that portion of risk from the insurance companies, and they obviously need to understand how much that risk is worth to them, how exposed they are to it. And that's where our research and our modelling comes in for the Australian market. So I guess you can see that we've been modelling climate risk for insurance and reinsurance for a number of years now. It's now really just kind of changed focus and changed name, with climate change becoming a thing in the private sector. But the actual modelling structure and the understanding of how extreme weather impacts buildings and human resources as well is something that's been going on for quite some time.
Yeah, yeah. So if you were to try and sum it up, what is climate risk? What are the things that you're looking at?
Yeah, so climate risk is a response, or is an effect of climate change, essentially. So when we talk about climate risk, we're referring to the risks and also the opportunities that exist to an organisation as a result of climate change. And it's a very fast-moving space. It's not the same as it looked 3 or 5 years ago. And there are three principal components of climate risk. There's the physical risk, there's transitional risk, and there's legal risk. So physical risk is what we focus on, and is the impact of changes to extreme weather and chronic climate stresses due to climate change, and how that impacts on asset integrity. So how that impacts your asset on the ground, your building, your piece of infrastructure. And sometimes also how that physical risk can be transferred to that asset through an organization's supply chain. There's then something called transition risk, which we don't directly deal with, but it's certainly a big piece of the climate risk space, which is more at an organizational level. How exposed is my organization to sectors in the economy that may become winners or losers as we transition to a net zero economy? And that's very much a global piece. And then finally is legal, again, an area that I'm not an expert in, but is very interesting, and certainly is a big driver, I think, for organizations to understand their climate risk. The extent to which boards and CEOs are becoming legally obliged to disclose the risks that the organization face from climate change. And there have been some interesting legal precedents set in different parts of the world over a number of years that are really making high level board members, CEOs, and the top end of organizations really sit up and listen and understand that climate risk or climate change is a material risk to their business, and it is actionable now. And I think that's really why it's a very exciting space to work in at the moment.
Could you describe how you go about assessing climate risk, especially on the physical space that you work in?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of the physical climate risk, I guess there are many ways to do it, but you start off with the climate models, the global climate models. So the IPCC, which you may or may not have heard of, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is the kind of the global body that is a scientific authority on climate modelling and climate change, and they bring out assessment reports. and there's one coming out this year. And the backbone of those assessment reports are a suite of climate models, a coupled model intercomparison project, which basically makes up about 100 different climate models. So we try and mine that data, we try and look at that climate model data, and we intersect it with business level data, so information on where a business will operate, where their assets are in the ground, and we do some, I guess, neat science in between to try and understand what is their current exposure to climate change, to climate risk, sorry, to extreme weather and chronic climate stresses, and how that might change in the future with climate change.
Is there an appetite for organisations to highlight their climate risks?
Yeah, certainly, and that is growing at a rate of knots. And you know, as I mentioned before, we've been doing this in the insurance sector for a number of decades now, under the auspices of NatCat risk or natural catastrophe risk. But the financial services sector in Australia and globally really has ramped up since about 2015. In 2015, there was a famous speech by Mark Carney, who was the then governor of the Bank of England, who coined the phrase "tragedy of the horizon," which I really like because I think it really sums up this whole area very nicely. That climate change and the risks posed to organisations because of climate change is always on the horizon, and from a financial perspective, that's the tragedy on the horizon. Since that speech, things have moved pretty quickly. There's a framework called the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, which has really catalysed the whole disclosure of financial risk in the private sector. And there are four pillars of that: governance, strategy, risk management, and metrics and targets. So since that was released, there has been a real big uptake in the number of organisations that are disclosing their financial risks. APRA, the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, and some others also have come out and said, actually a number of years ago now, that climate risk is material to organisations and is actionable. And while this framework and this disclosure movement is still non-statutory, it's still not regulated, there is the expectation and very strong signals that this is going to become regulated quite quickly, and also maybe even legalized. I mean, in New Zealand last year, first country in the world to come out and say that they will make it a legal requirement for organizations that domiciled in New Zealand to disclose their climate risk as of 2023. And also even last week, the Bank of England has come out and said that the UK may also do the same thing by 2022. So, yeah, a very, very interesting and fast-moving space at the moment.
So besides the insurance companies, what other companies require climate risk profiles?
Yeah, so, I mean, pretty much any organisation that has physical assets on the ground, any organisation that has built infrastructure, that owns infrastructure or that invests in infrastructure, will be exposed in some way to physical climate risk. And even those organisations that don't actually have any physical assets on the ground will be impacted or affected in some way by transitional risk, by the transition of macro scale economies to net zero by mid-century. So certainly with regard to TCFD and the area that we're working, I think it has been the financial services sector that has really spearheaded this at the moment. And insurance is very nimble. They can often readjust their premiums on short timescales, but have a very, very good understanding of what extreme weather and climate means to their business operations. But I mean, beyond that, really any sector you can think of: communications, energy, many different levels of government, healthcare, IT, real estate, certainly transportation, utilities. It's very much wide ranging.
Yeah, I guess a lot of them can have a knock-on effect from whatever perhaps physical bricks and mortar site. If that was to let's say, I don't know, a power station near a coast or coast gets damaged, and then the knock-on effect for all of those that work with it is part of their climate risk profile, I assume.
Exactly right, yeah. So you can't take any of this isolated or in situ, because we very much live in a connected world. And I mean, what you refer to there is essentially supply chain risk. So either inheriting, even if your power station, let's say, doesn't have any immediate climate risk to it, it may inherit some climate risk through its supply chain, or it may pass on climate risk to other organisations or individuals who don't have climate risk to themselves in situ. So it's a very complex piece to model and to get a handle on. That supply chain risk is certainly a big aspect to it, though, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose it could spiral out of control in terms of the amount of data you could end up having to put together to analyse that.
That's right. And I really think that one of the challenges that we're facing at the moment is that the questions that are being asked of the climate model data, that the climate models are not, or they haven't been traditionally built to answer those questions. So there's still a bit of a gap there between the granularity with which organisations would like to use climate data for, and the ability and the limits of climate models to answer those questions. And I'll give you one example, and that's around extreme weather and climate. Climate models, global climate models, often operate on spatial scales of about 50 to 100 kilometres. You certainly can get more granular and more highly resolved climate models than that. But at those spatial scales, they don't resolve well extreme weather events. And if we're trying to pick out points rather than a grid, we're really going to that data with a level of granularity that it's not really there for yet. So I'd say probably that's one of the challenges at the moment. A lot of people are getting on board with this. It's still early days. It's still very much in its infancy. The climate model data is getting better very, very quickly with increases in computer power. But there is still that discord there, I think, between the two disciplines.
Yeah, yeah. So focusing on coastal zones, because obviously most of here in Australia, most of our major cities are on coastal zones. What are some of the major issues surrounding climate risk in these areas?
I mean, coastal is certainly an area of interest to me. And I think within the Australian perspective, it really highlights the fact that when we talk about risk, climate risk, there are three elements to climate risk. And up until this point, we've been focusing on changes in the hazard, which is changes in extreme weather or chronic climate stresses. But it's also the exposure component and the vulnerability component to it. So essentially where people choose to live and how people choose to live. And, you know, there's famous examples of erosion hotspots along the east coast of Australia, one of those being Corroy Narrabeen on the northern beaches in Sydney, and a couple more dotted up the coast. And really it's a well-known fact that half of the problem there is really a legacy of inappropriate development in the active beach zone. Infrastructure being built on a dune, on a sand dune, essentially, artificially holding what is really a dynamic coastal line. And we're faced with the problem of how we deal with that, because each time a cost-benefit analysis has to be done as to whether what is the most sustainable approach. Do we put a seawall in? Do we nourish the beach? Do we do something else? And I'd have to say that over time, these problems are probably just going to become more acute and more expensive to deal with.
Yeah, yeah. So is that sort of the large changes that you see in the future, that with the events changing and climate perhaps getting more severe, that these areas are going to be even more at risk?
Yeah, certainly. I don't think it's going to help the situation, that's for sure. I mean, even if, let's say, we have no change in storm patterns, so on the east coast of Australia, east coast lows are certainly a big erosion event. A little bit further up, tropical cyclones are as well. Even assuming that there is no change in those extreme weather events with climate change, sea level rise alone is going to increase the impact of any storm event on the coast, because you have a higher sea level, the waves can reach higher up, and there's more potential for those waves to impact and erode the dunes where people are living. So the hazard component to this is certainly not going to get any better. The exposure component appears to be fairly fixed. So there's something in that equation that needs to change, unfortunately. And you know, as real estate, especially in coastal areas, continues to increase in price, that cost benefit exercise that gets done every time a new coastal management scheme or defence needs to get put in, we'll have to get reassessed. So you know, very, very complex issues. These are people's livelihoods that we're talking about, but it's certainly not going to get any easier, I don't think, into the future.
Yeah. So could you provide a little bit of background on the recent flooding? Obviously, there's been huge floods on the East Coast, and what the potential role of climate change is in this and for future flood events?
Yes. So, I'm sure everyone knows that over the past couple of weeks, we've experienced a lot of flooding across the southeast Australian and the eastern seaboard area. And it has been an extreme flood event for many people. And there's two real aspects that I think feed into why this has become such an extreme flood event. The first one being that we've just come off the back of a wetter than normal summer that has been a result in part from something called La Nina. So we have these oscillations in the Pacific called El Nino Southern Oscillation. El Nino events often cause drier than normal and more stable conditions across southeast Australia, whereas La Nina events are associated with a high probability of floods and tropical cyclones on this side of the coast. Certainly not to say that floods and tropical cyclones can't exist outside La Nina. They certainly can, and sometimes we'll get a La Nina period that we don't get any major flooding or cyclones, just that the observational record shows us that, on balance, the dice is rolled in favour of floods during periods of La Nina. So we came off the back of a wetter than normal summer, which meant that a lot of the catchments were already near saturation point, meaning that a lot of the rain was runoff flowing into rivers and river levels rose quite quickly. The other aspect to it was that it was a really stationary event. It didn't move on. It was being held in place by a high-pressure system in the southern Tasman Sea, which didn't allow it to move. And so it was drawing a lot of moisture from the Tasman Sea and raining out over the eastern seaboard. And it was an event that lasted 4 or 5 days. So for those two reasons, it became quite extreme, and you know, you can certainly see the link there between climate oscillations, climate variability. With regard to climate change, it is a much more difficult task to ascertain the contribution that climate change has made to the probability of these events occurring. And over the coming weeks, months, and years, I'm sure these studies will be done, and they're called climate attribution studies. And that they are often done after extreme weather events. So we don't really know what the role of climate change is to this singular event. But what we do know is that most projections point towards a drying out of the mean Australian climate, but an increase in the intensity of extreme rain events. So this really means that we could, in the future, with climate change, with global warming, face the prospect of increased flash flood events into the future.
So we heard on the news one in 100-year floods. Could you give us some clarification on what this really means?
Yeah, so a 100-year flood essentially refers to a flood event that is expected to occur on average once every 100 years. But there's been a lot of media interest in this terminology over the past couple of weeks because it can be quite misleading. And the reason for that is that we should really be expressing this, I think, in terms of percentages. So a 100-year flood basically means that on average you can expect that kind of flood event to occur you have a 1% chance of it occurring every year. That doesn't mean to say that you won't get 2 or 3 or 4 100-year events in a 100-year period. That's certainly possible just from a statistical perspective. And it also doesn't mean that you have a 100% chance of experiencing the 100-year event in a 100-year period. You actually have a 63% chance from statistical probability. So I guess superimposed on top of that is this aspect of climate variability and oscillations. And as I mentioned before, La Nina really rolls the dice in favour of floods. And so you're more likely to get a cluster of floods, or you're more likely to get flooding during periods of La Nina. So we've been calling for a number of years now for there to be a change in the terminology from referring to these events as 100-year events, because people feel that if they've just experienced the 100-year event, then they're okay again for another 100 years, which is certainly not the case, to more expressing these in terms of what's the probability of my property being flooded over the lifetime of my mortgage. And when we start talking about it in terms of percentage like that, I think it adds immediacy to the discourse around people aren't really understanding their flood risk.
So in the areas that, where the floods are, what is the probability in of floods, if it's okay for you to disclose, if not, not?
Yeah, so you probably can't define a single probability for these areas because they are very large. And each region will have a different probability. I mean, we've looked into the rainfall intensities of this event over the past week, and certainly the amount of rainfall we saw was quite incredible. I can say that the highest rain gauge observation was Nambucca Heads on the mid-north coast, and that over a period of 7 days received almost a metre of rain. Which is really quite extraordinary. And from the limited observations that we've got, that looks to be an event that, going back to this problematic terminology, that may be experienced once every 2,000 years. So it's a really quite incredible rainfall volume. That was an outlier. A lot of the other areas probably experienced rainfall that was between the 50-year to 100-year or having a 1 to 2% chance of exceedance in any given year.
And are you seeing in your time and of looking at these an increase in these weather events and the damage they're causing?
Yeah, so that's certainly often a question that we get asked. One way to look at the cost of natural hazard events or extreme weather events is, in Australia at least, is to use something called the Insurance Council of Australia's Disaster Loss List. And this is a list of the insured losses of natural disasters in Australia going back to the mid-1960s. And we did a normalisation piece for the ICA, which basically means we, instead of looking at the raw data, we normalised the cost of natural disasters back to the mid-1960s relative to 2017 socioeconomic levels. And when you look at the raw data, and this is the same in practically every country or global data set, you'll see that the cost of natural disasters through time rises almost exponentially. It really is very large. And I think probably at first glance you could perhaps take that as inference that there's some kind of change in the hazard, or it could be a climate change signal. However, once you normalise for changes in inflation, changes in population, and a range of other things, there's actually no trend through time. And this really requires a little bit of thought as to why that might be the case. What it really is telling us is not necessarily that there is no climate change signal there, but the risk in terms of dollar value is driven not only by changes in the hazard because of climate change, let's say, but also, as I mentioned before, where we choose to live and how we choose to live. And, you know, with more people living, let's say, in coastal zones, with more people exposed to natural hazard events, and with the cost of living and inflation in general rising, of course, the cost of natural disasters are going to increase through time. And there have been some studies showing that the climate change signal can be elucidated from lost records. It just takes quite a long time to become statistically significant. So certainly when we're talking about climate change, we shouldn't just be focusing, I don't think, on the change of the hazard, because that human aspect to things is very important aspect of risk as well.
Yeah, yeah. So in your opinion, what would you say is the cause, or is this something that's still to be undetermined, or many, many factors?
The cause in the change in cost through time, is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, so basically the cause in the change through cost through time, but also the cause of the extreme event. So it's kind of like a two-part question, sorry.
Yeah. So, the first part, we don't see a change through time when we account for socioeconomic factors. But the second question, in terms of changes to extreme weather events with climate change, one thing I would say, and is very strong ground in the climate science community now, is that we can say with high confidence that the increase in the mean global temperature over the past 100 to 150 years is a result of anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions. And this, you know, often gets debated outside, I think, climate science as to which, you know, political standpoint you're aligned to. But it's really a resolved question, I'd say, within this climate science community. And the reason for that is that climate models are very good at replicating historical changes in mean global temperature. If we run the models over the historical period, and we input every boundary forcer that we know of, including greenhouse gases, and we compare the model results to observations, they align very well. We can model the historical increase in temperature. If we then rerun those models, taking out greenhouse gas forcing, the global mean temperature essentially flatlines. So we can infer with a high level of confidence that the difference between those two curves, essentially the increase in temperature, is a result of greenhouse gases. Now, that's where the models are on strong ground. Where, as I mentioned before, they still have some difficulties in is extreme weather events. From a theoretical perspective, if you imagine a bell curve, which is a normal distribution, if you shift the mean of any curve, you shift the position of the tails as well. And the tails represent those extreme weather events. So what we know is happening is the curve is flattening out. So we're getting more variability in the tails. And the tails themselves are increasing. So we're getting more, the probability of experiencing extreme weather events in any one location is increasing because of the increase in mean temperature.
Yeah, yeah. And it's good to hear from a scientist that is resolved throughout the science community. I mean, obviously doing what we do, we get a lot of kickback from people just saying, you know, we don't know what we're talking about. It's been like this. We've gone through this again. It's the same pattern that's ever been there before. But it's nice to hear that the science community has resolved this, and therefore we must all act on it.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, you can never have 100% certainty in anything, but with regard to scientific experiments, you would certainly attach a high level of confidence to that assertion. And, you know, that's not new. That's not just me saying it. It's been an assertion that has been made by several IPCC reports now. So we're kind of moving on to the next level, I think, in the science community.
Yeah, yeah. So with these climate events unfolding over the past few years and floods right now, and understanding that you have a young family, what keeps you up at night?
Yeah, so, well, there's been many things that keep me up at night that are not related to climate risk, but I guess
young children generally do.
They do, yeah. That's more of a practical reason. Yeah. But sticking on topic, I'd probably just say that, just cognizant of the fact that you know, we've all got a role to play in this, and really just ensuring a sustainable future for the next generation, that they have the same opportunities that we do. Very, you know, cognizant of the fact that climate change and climate risk can manifest itself in many different forms, and it's not just that we might experience some more hot days into the future. It very, very much does trickle down all the way through to every aspect of the economy and society, you know, through from housing affordability to you know, insurance premiums and affordability as well. So I think, you know, it's an opportunity that we have to act on now, and it's certainly an exciting space. So I'm, you know, hopeful that these global mitigation efforts will certainly come off. There's also a lot of hope in terms of the technological advances that we're seeing at the moment, and also the progress of the science. As I mentioned to you, you know, now we are in a position where we can say with high confidence certain things within climate science, and that is very comforting, I think, and allows us to move on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I hear quite a lot that it's our greatest threat, but also our greatest opportunity at the moment with how things are changing. What sort of thing would you say, if you were to sum it up into one or two things, would be what makes you optimistic for the future?
Yes, I'd probably say first off that the fast pace of climate risk disclosures. We certainly, you know, can have our own opinions as to what governments in different countries are doing and how slowly or fastly they're responding to climate change. But this is really being driven from a financial services perspective. And this is a now problem. It's been realised, we've gone beyond that this is a future problem. This is actionable, it's material. It will impact organisations' bottom line. And that's why it's really being taken seriously now, very fast-moving space. I think also that you know, the generation that's growing up now, Gen Z and the millennials, have certainly grown up with climate change at being at the forefront of their minds and really understanding the ramifications of that. And as I previously mentioned, I think really a reason to be optimistic is the quality with which we do have at our fingertips climate data to answer some of these questions. And also some of the really exciting advances that are happening across a range of different sectors in terms of technologies that could help us in our mitigation efforts against climate warming.
How can people reach you if they want further information on climate risk and they need that as part of their company's requirements?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you can go to our website, riskfrontiers.com. You can email me at thomas.mortlock@riskfrontiers.com. And whether it's a specific inquiry or something general, certainly happy to try and answer questions where I can.
That's brilliant. And our final question, if there is one thing we can all change that will have a massive impact on the health of our planet, what would that be? How can we be good?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this question, and you know, there's many things you can do, and there's probably many things that you've heard before that you can do. And before I say this, I certainly would put in the caveat that you should never take investment advice from a climate scientist. but on reflection, I would say that probably the biggest lever that any one individual has is where they invest their money, especially with respect to superannuation. There are a lot of really good sustainable funds out there that are outperforming benchmarks, that are performing very well, comparable to other growth funds. And as I mentioned before, with regard to ESG, which is environmental, sustainable and governance aspects to investing, responsible investment is becoming a big deal. And it's through investor pressure. So I'd probably say that, you know, the biggest pot of money that you're sitting on are your retirement savings. And there, I wouldn't say there's low risk in changing things, but there's certainly an opportunity there for those that want to go down the responsible investment route to look at certain ETFs or, you know, or different funds that really do account for all those different aspects of climate risk that we've covered today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very, very much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I think we're going to take some time and try and figure out and understand all the bits of the climate risk side of things. But it's a fascinating role that you do, and thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been a good opportunity. Thank you.
You're welcome. Take care. Well, that was the extremely busy Thomas Mortlock. What an amazing amount of information that was to take in.
Indeed. Thank you, Thomas, for being on our podcast and allowing us to interview you. We know you were really busy and you had to fit this in amongst all the other work they have to do at the moment. I think what we take a lot of information with us from this interview, but I think there's two important points to discuss. First of all, the fact that the science community did not continue the debate on whether or not we are going through the climate change and that is man-made. And that was a really good point to take from it. So from now on, maybe we stop discussing whether or not that is the case or if there are the people that are thinking differently.
Yeah, we just draw a line under it. That's it. It's been agreed on by so many scientists that it's now unquestionable. And that's it. It's done. We've now got to move on with how we can help resolve it, reduce it, or make it better, because there are some people working extremely hard to try and reverse this as well.
I think, as one of our previous guests, John Grimes, said, there are so many options available to us, we just need to embrace them. We have the solutions, we just need to embrace the solutions and carry on.
That's right.
And I think the other thing that we need to take is our other thing to add to our How to Be Good list, which is where you invest your money. That's probably an important thing, and thanks, Thomas, for reminding us of that, and especially here in Australia, where you invest your super.
Absolutely. It makes a big difference. We've seen just recently there was a post that came out showing a number of banks and institutions and super organizations that are still investing in fossil fuels and coal and agriculture, large agriculture, and actually weapons as well was something I was completely shocked by, but that's still one of their investment streams. So if we make that change and move to people with a more ethical approach, and more people do it, those institutions will realize that they've got to change where they're putting their money or our money and how they're investing it.
And I think we can actually post that information on our Instagram and Facebook pages, perhaps put a link to it on our show notes as well. If you have any other information with regards to other financial institutions, just comment and we'll add it to the list. And yeah, let's just invest better and more sustainable.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we'll put all those details on the show notes. And we just want to say thank you. And obviously, subscribe. We would love more reviews. Reviews really help us go forward. And as ever, this is funded by you. And we have our Patreon site through our website. So please donate whatever you can, help us out with a cup of coffee or whatever it might be, or even more, to try and get Anchor's tattoo, which we're still waiting to see done, where she gets the tree.
Oh yes, I think we've mentioned on every single podcast since we started this, on two of our membership options you can plant 3 trees per month, or the other one is 5 trees per month.
Absolutely. And we have a big announcement to make very soon. We can't unfortunately say it this time, but keep posted both here and on social media, and yeah, you'll know very soon. As soon as we are able to say it, we will do.
Looking forward to it.
Absolutely. Take care, stay safe, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.